She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I promise you, we are going to be giving you lots of good things to think about for this show today. Our show is made possible today due to the generous support of the University of Arizona, and we thank them for their support of the Mrs. Green's World mission and vision. So the name of our show today is First Order Concerns in Earth Science. And I am thrilled to have as my guest, my friend, Joaquin Ruiz. He is the Dean of the College of Science at the University of Arizona. And of course, that's not all. Dr. Ruiz is also the Vice President of Innovation and Strategy, Executive Dean, College of Letters, Arts, and Science, and Professor of Geosciences. And as I was writing this up and preparing for the show, I thought about him a lot because I know him. He's also a father and a husband. And I wondered about, I've never asked you about, do you sleep?
I do.
You do? That's good. You must, because you keep on going. So we have lots of questions. I told Joaquin before the show started that this is going to be kind of a Charlie Rose interview, where there are going to be some really very precise topics we talk about, and then we'll go wax philosophical a little bit. Are you good with that?
I'm fine.
It's just going to be fun. So the first question is a long one, but as a scientist with equal abilities in chemistry and geology, you're able to address many first-order problems in earth science. It's big. So two examples I pulled were the development of new isotope systems for studying ore deposits, which, of course, I have no earthly idea exactly what that is, and the tectonic processes involved in the growth of the evolution of Mexico. Important things that you're doing. My show is about educating the public. And I guess my big question is, with all on your plate in the many titles that you wear, what does a day look like for you, and how do you go about making sure that you are addressing first-order concerns? That is a Charlie Rose kind of question.
Wow.
It really is.
Well, it starts with about 3 cups of coffee.
Good way. Yes. There's the truth. Supercharged.
That's right. Well, every day is different, which is what makes my life so interesting. A day can have conversations with faculty that are being hired at the University of Arizona. So I learn a lot about things that I've never heard about, which go from psychology to astronomy. That's as Dean of the College of Science. I also have a lab, and in my lab, which is fortunately in the same building as my office as Dean, it's where I do my research. Sadly, I think if you talk to any scientist that is an experimentalist, because that's what I am, I'm not a theoretician, and you get so busy, when I go into my lab, they won't even let me near the instruments anymore because they think I'll break them, and they're probably right that I'll break something. But at least once a day, I meet with somebody with whom I am working directly in science. And I use these isotopes that I've been using forever to try to understand the geochemical evolution of the Earth. In other words, how did the Earth come to its state that we know today in 4.5 billion years? And that's what I've been doing all my life. But now these isotope systems, which were not developed for that, but used for that, I can now use in anthropology. So I've been looking at turquoise routes, for example.
Interesting.
And we also now are interested in using these isotopes to trace the source of food. So an example of that is chocolate. And depending what country in Africa the chocolate comes from, you can bet that it can either have some child labor abuses or not. So companies in food are quite interested to know where their stuff originates from, and I've just gotten interested in that, and that's what I'm working on now. So it's all over the place. And then, of course, I also have to think about strategies for the college and strategies for the biosphere, which isn't part of the college, and its telescopes and whatnot. So every day is different.
There are first-order concerns about the Earth, and then first-order concerns about you keeping everything robust and on top of the sciences and on top of the best people that are working in those. So it's a big job. When you talk about something like tracing the trail of turquoise, how relate that to us? What do you learn from that, and how do you apply it to be useful for what we need to know in terms of where we are as a planet?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not exactly sure if the if tracing turquoise and understanding how turquoise was used by the Aztecs and whether that came from Arizona or not, for example, those are the questions. Whether that has more any impact that's greater than just understanding who we are and where we come from kind of stuff. But at the same time, we use some of our knowledge to try to understand specifically when some cities were abandoned. And that then can relate to things that I know are close to your heart, which is whether they're related to climate variability or loss of water or both. And in that regard, everything sort of is connected with everything. And the most basic of questions that you may be asking sometimes comes about to be fundamental to understand some crisis of the day.
And, you know, in terms, it's interesting that you bring up the issue of what I call fair trade and, more importantly, social justice. Mm-hmm. As I have evolved in this role of Mrs. Green, I was very, you know, I was in a learning curve of what state the oceans are in and how fast is climate change accelerating. In the past couple of years, my focus and what I want to incorporate in almost all of my interviews and in my writing are the social justice issues. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's because I evolved or because there is a lot more focus and transparency about things. Where does your chocolate come from? You can be darn sure that I know and I care, and I know that the political will is putting pressure on places like Hershey's and Nestle. There have been some, you know, some forward motion. What is your sense of, has it always been there and now being, you know, the transparency is helping us focus more? When it terms climate change, like Joaquin, the joke that I have, oh yeah, if they're going to do something bad, it's more than likely going to be put in marginalized communities, low-income areas. Things that are bad for the planet are bad for people. So what's your sense of, how's it trending, or has it really been there and now we're just talking about it?
No, I actually think it's become a bigger issue because global climate change, which is obviously an environmental issue, is global. Everybody's worried about the health, and I wouldn't actually describe it this way, but everybody does, the health of our planet. But in the end, there's everybody recognizes that there are going to be huge differences, which you can sort of divide into four aspects. One of them is that have to do with societies. One of them has to do with sea level elevation. The second one has to do with water availability. The third has to do with food safety and security. So, but if you think of and of course the fourth, which is just how prepared are we to be in a place which is hotter? And we've seen already heat waves in Europe where people actually died because they're not used to it. So it is a concern. But in the end, if you look at those four issues that I've just described, the people that are going to take it really hard are the ones that don't have a way of getting out of the way. So islands that are going to be flooded, semi-arid environments which are going to become arid, and food safety and security, which means that there will be less food for those that are already struggling, and with less protein, because we already know, for example, that as temperature increases, rice produces less protein as it grows, as an example. The yield of corn is less. So all these items that are fundamental to folks with little to will hit them harder. So global climate change, in the end, is a social issue, period. I mean, if you're in a skyscraper in New York City, it's not going to affect you all that much with your air conditioner because you'll buy the food and so on. Now, if you happen to be in the coast in Miami, well, that's an issue. But nevertheless, you probably have the means to move out of the way. Not everybody, but some. But in general, as global climate change progresses, there's no doubt about it that it becomes a social issue. And I think that then sort of bleeds into all kinds of other environmental issues that weren't at the front page of the newspapers every day.
They weren't.
Right.
They weren't. And now they are. So as a leader, as you truly are a thought leader, you're an innovator, you've started a number of wonderful things here in our community. As the leader of so many people and so many teams at the University of Arizona and at Biosphere 2, what do you do to incorporate that thinking and make sure that it permeates the thoughts that you're, you know, the research that you're doing with your team?
Only a small part of what I do actually does that. I mean, okay. I talk about social justice and inequality in education all the time. That's okay. Sort of central to my job. As director of the Biosphere, there I actually deal with these issues of the environment and social aspects and social issues. So as you know, we are now going to have this event called One Young World at the Biosphere.
So exciting. Yeah. So we really have to spend some time talking
sure.
about that.
So there I'm bringing three. This year it's going to be 300, but we hope that next year and the years to come it's at least 500 people that are interested in the environment and that 18 to 30-year-old kind of population. So I'm excited about that. I'm also excited, and I'm pushing very hard to create opportunities for our undergraduate students to create technologies that are relevant to third world issues. These would be things like greenhouses that are off-grid, DC grids in places where there's no electricity. Those are two aspects that come to mind right away. But they're, you know, how do you clean water and all this kind of stuff, what actually your one-year world is going to be dealing with. So what I my sort of soapbox at the moment is to create an environment where we can magnify the issues so that everybody knows about them, and that environment would be One Young World at the Biosphere. And also through the Biosphere, create opportunities and research that deal with these issues.
It's interesting to me because there's a whole school of thought about conferences and what can be accomplished, and is it a feel-good thing or does it change you? Can it be transformative? And from my personal experience, the more I get out there, the more I learn, the more I grow, the more I'm challenged. So it's really helped me with going to conferences around the country to expand my view, expand my vision, expand the kind of guests I interview. One Young World International, to me, is a really big deal.
Mm-hmm.
I read a lot about it. This conference in particular is One Young World, specifically the first one on the environment. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So that's big, and it's a big deal. Of course, I'm proud. I'm a Biosphere card-carrying placard saying, are you kidding me? You haven't been out there yet. So tell me why it's so important.
It's important for two reasons. One of them is just, this is just flat-out selfish, right? And it is to bring an understanding in the world about the capacity that we have in our community, in our university, to make a difference.
Yes. So, press pause, everybody. That's huge. I mean, it is. I got goosebumps.
Right.
So that's
number one. And number two, I do believe that these meetings are transformative. I mean, unless you go to a meeting like Coachella, right, where you're going to sort of listen to music
and
do selfies.
Just have fun and tune out.
Yeah,
exactly.
But these kinds of meetings, first of all, are expensive. So you're going to come only if you have the money or your company sends you or whatever. It's the right population. It's 18 to 30-year-olds, which means that these are the leaders in the field that are driven to make a difference. And if you're driven to make a difference, it is important that you connect with other people that are driven to make a difference. And also, some of the speakers are going to talk about, you know, their view of what's possible and what isn't. So these kinds of meetings are actually, in my view, very important. I mean, I've gone to scientific meetings all my life on my own discipline of geochemistry. And certainly they make a difference because they educate you about what's going on. They connect you to people that are doing things that maybe you want to be working with. So in some ways, all these meetings like One Young World are reinventing what the scientific community, well, all communities, all learned communities have been doing forever.
Right.
But they're broadening them up. You don't have to be a member of any club, which is even more exciting. And I think the granddaddy of all these meetings, there are two granddaddies of all these meetings, they're very different, but they, one of them is a Davos meeting, of course, in Davos, Switzerland, which I think One Young World is trying to emulate, but with young kids instead of heads of state. But they wouldn't be going there spending, the heads of state now at Davos, spending $50,000 if they thought it was a waste of time. And of course, the other transformative meeting, which is a different example, are the TED Talks.
Yes, yes.
Right?
Yes.
And then there are a whole bunch more that their Aspen Festival of Ideas, and I can just go on and on. And each one of these are packed with people. Some of them, like I would say Aspen and others like Aspen, it's really people just want to keep learning, not necessarily act. What I really like about One Young World is that these they're young folks that are coming here not just to learn to make themselves better in whatever small way they would, but they're here to learn so that they can actually expand the opportunities for them to make a big difference. So that's what I really like about One Young World.
And what I loved is that, you know, there were so many conversations and front page news and a little bit of follow-up about, you know, COP21, the mm-hmm. climate change talks in Paris, mm-hmm. they're going to continue those conversations
right.
and continue the discussion and keep it alive. And the other part that I observe from your conversation is there's so many silos in the world of climate change and not enough integration of thought. And to me, this screams integration of thought, cross-pollination of ideas and continued learning.
Mm-hmm.
That
you got it.
Okay. I mean, I just think it's wonderful. So who all's coming? Is it global? Are kids coming from, not their kids, anyone under 40 to me is a kid. So I just say that young adults, young people.
Yes. They're from all over the world. And we have speakers. I'm not sure what they're called, speakers. But anyway, there are people that are going to be presenting that go all the way from the ex-president of Peru to the head of, I think it's sustainability of GE, to folks from Bechtel, and then a bunch of non-for-profits that have made a big difference. So it's a hodgepodge. I urge you to go on the web of One Young World and look at the agenda, because the agenda is posted. It's going to be very, very exciting.
And I'm about 100% sure I know your answer to that. I know your passion for the Biosphere 2. I really am a fan, and not just a fan. I'm really connected to why it's important out there. And we are, what I wanted to ask you is, do you think it's really significant, other than for selfish reasons, that so many more people will be learning about Biosphere 2 and all the magic that happens under the domes out there? Do you think it's an exceptional environment for this first one on the environment?
Well, of course, the biosphere is iconic.
It is. It clearly is.
Yeah, it's an iconic structure that, if anything, just on its own, allows you to think of possibilities if you have the right imagination. So when it was built, it was an amazingly imaginative place. And of course, it's sort of interesting because the biosphere, this is its 25th anniversary. And the first 5 years were the years of the biospherians, right?
Right, right.
But since then, when Columbia ran it, and then we've now had it for 10 years, the last 20 years has been first-rate research on the environment. So it's more now than just an iconic structure.
Totally.
It is a place where you can actually see exactly what you're saying. We do research at the biosphere, which is without silos. That's what makes it so interesting.
The whole integration and people are right. under one roof talking to each other. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit more about biosphere and what happens out there and some of the experiences of the people that I've brought. And then we're going to talk about some of the other events, the Beyond B2 events. I'm very curious about the online chemistry course that got a Google Award. We have lots more to talk about with Joaquin Reese. My questions are never ending. Everybody, please stay here with me. We will be right back.
I hope that was okay.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Pacific Time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio app. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. We are a proud member of the Dream Vision 7, Glimmerglass, Green Radio Divas, Blog Talk, and Speak Up Radio Networks. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. And now, more with Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for being with us. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I like to say, kind of, I don't want this to be a pithy remark, but thinking is really important. And there are lots of important things that we get an invitation to think about from the amazing guests we have on this show. Just another quick shout out to thank the University of Arizona, not just for their support of the Mrs. Green's World mission and vision, but for all the support and the difference they make for this community, for our country, and for the planet. They're doing so many things on many fronts, and I'm proud to be a U of A alum, and I'm proud to have the Mrs. Green's World International Headquarters centered right here in Tucson, Arizona. So the name of our show today is First Order Concerns in Earth Science. Joining me in studio for this hour is Joaquin Reese. He is the Dean of the College of Science at the University of Arizona and also the Vice President of Innovation and Strategy, Executive Dean, College of Letters, Arts, and Science. Someday, Joaquin, we're just going to have you go through all your jobs. We're going to have you on the show and tell you what everything you do, and Professor of Geosciences at the University of Arizona. So, Joaquin, in terms of the One Young World Environmental Summit that's coming up next week, why is it, I think it's extra spectacular that they will get to be experiencing this at the Biosphere 2. What are some of the reasons why?
Well, one, I think, is, as I mentioned right before the break, it is an iconic structure. So when the Biosphere was built 25 years ago, it was built specifically to try to understand how the Earth worked. And the idea was how these biomes all together can actually make the world work. The secondary aspect of the Biosphere to maybe create the intellectual property to go to Mars or the Moon or whatever, that came later. It was not the original intent of when the Biosphere was built. So the biomes that were built in the Biosphere were specific biomes that we needed to know more about. And that if you went in the field and looked, for example, at the ocean, or you looked at the rainforest, the variables out there are so complex that measuring anything that made it really was important was very difficult, especially in those days. So that's why the Biosphere was built. All right. So its stint with the biospherians in there, it came back to its original purpose. And you may remember that the biosphere, when it was run under Columbia, what Columbia was quite interested in was trying to understand how the Earth would react to increased CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere. So because a biosphere is sealed, you could crank up the CO2. So
right.
Unlike the original experiment in which it was built to try to modulate itself, and it didn't, right? Which is quite interesting because it immediately showed us how little we understand for the feedback loops of the Earth. But when Columbia took over, they felt that at that point that the real key questions, because we really didn't understand Earth systems and how they operate to modulate the Earth, that it would be interesting then to measure what happens to the ocean as you increase the CO2. What happens to the rainforest as you increase CO2? So a couple of things that they discovered, which were big, big deals. One of them was that at 400 ppm CO2, which is what we have now. So when they were doing the experiments, they were like at 320 or something.
Unbelievable.
At 400 ppm, the ocean acidified and the coral died. And guess what's happening today? Exactly what was shown at the biosphere. That was the first experiment that showed that. Then the second experiment, which was very important, had to do with the physiology of the rainforest, how these plants actually operate, and how much CO2 they could actually take. And they showed that at 600 parts per million CO2, the rainforest really couldn't take any more. I mean, it was about it. So there's always been this theory out there that CO2 is the greatest of fertilizers. So the more CO2 you have, the more stuff you can grow.
Right.
Right? The first indications that was not exactly quite right were also at the biosphere. Because as you increase the CO2, the plants may grow faster, but they get all stressed out and their physiology changes. In the case of the rainforest, it started emitting greenhouse gases. Now we know, so that was an indication that sort of things just can't keep going and grow faster and be greener. Now we know, of course, that as CO2 increases, as I mentioned before, the protein content of rice goes down significantly, and half of the world, or more, I don't know how much, but a lot of the world basically eats rice as its main part of their diet. So they'll have less protein with the same amount of rice. So that was another really interesting research project that went on at the biosphere when Columbia took it over. When we took it over, the projects that we're very interested in, one of them is called the Landscape Evolution Observatory, and that's the first large-scale experiment that describes how the availability of water as you change vegetation because of global climate change. It can change for whatever reason, but we think vegetation is going to be changing throughout the world because global climate change is changing. And then, of course, what happens as you change the vegetation is that the amount of humidity that goes into the air changes because of the evapotranspiration capacity of the plants. Each plant will do it differently. So that changes the weather, not only the climate, but it changes that. And it also changes the availability of water that will be used for people to use because the runoff will be different. The amount of water in the subsurface will be different. So we have this enormous experiment in which we're measuring all these things. We, as scientists, call it the mass balance of water. As we're measuring the availability of water for human consumption. That's never been done at the scale that we're doing it. So there, and that experiment, going back to the silos, that experiment was designed, created, and is now being managed by ecologists, atmospheric scientists, hydrologists, geoscientists, and soil and water scientists. So it's really across the whole disciplinary aspect of water interests. So it's really very exciting.
Under the domes. And I don't think there is a topic, I may be wrong, that concerns John Q. Public more than water scarcity.
Right.
Everybody gets it. Like, what if I don't have water? I mean, all the smart people are getting it. I just have to say that. And when I talk to people, and I thankfully rarely come up against this or interface with people that, you know, the climate change myth and it's just blah, 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 and I don't start hearing them. What I want to say to them, and sometimes I do you have any understanding for how pervasive the impact is? Whether you believe man caused it or whoever caused it, it doesn't matter. It's happening. It's measurable. But the food you eat, it's not just, you know, climate change comes down very real and very hard for me in terms of how it's going to impact and is already. It's not going to. There are many, many marginalized at-risk populations already that are suffering the impacts. But like you said, not us.
Right.
We're fine. It's all fine in our little, you know, houses with our flush toilets and our showers and all that. But
that's right.
Back to biosphere. I didn't really go off on a whirling dervish moment with Mrs. Green. But what I think about in terms of biosphere is when I bring groups there, because very, we have a wonderful partnership for Arizona's Greenest Workplace Challenge, which is a lot of work for us, but we do it to raise the consciousness in the community and around Arizona about how your workplace can impact the climate and the environment and on and on. When I take groups out there, I always go, and it's always it's grandmothers, you know, people that won the contest and their children and their spouses. It's magic to watch what happens when people are engaged out there. They don't get it. Mm-hmm. They really don't get it. When you're bringing all of these scientists and these young leaders, do you think they'll get it?
Yeah.
That this is really important? Are you going to do things to say this is what happens here and it's why it matters so much?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Because that's huge for me.
Yeah, and I think the integrative aspect of the biosphere and its scale, it just hits you in the face even if you don't want it to.
Absolutely right. I couldn't have put it better myself. You get out there and you're like, you've got to be kidding me.
Right.
And you go from one, you know, atmosphere and environment to the next and to the next and the next. The lung is actually my favorite thing.
Yeah.
Don't ask me why, but it wows people.
Yeah.
It blows them away. What happens when you just open the door
right. And
you see things, you know, it's what provides the oxygen for the entire facility. And the kids, oh my gosh, but it's wonderful learning and engagement and not just a tourist attraction.
Right.
It's so much more.
So you should know that because you've been to the biosphere, one of the biomes is this desert. And we're going to be transforming that biome so that we can do research on food. So next time you go there, maybe you will be seeing really high-tech food production, which includes LED lighting and very high-tech irrigation techniques. And that goes all the way from tilapia farming down to, we don't really know what kind of stuff we want to grow in there yet. But we're working on it now. So it'll be as big as Leo, but this one will have to do with food.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's really great. And, you know, I think this is a little sidebar, but it's very exciting, and I like to do shout-outs about Tucson because Arizona is in the news for such negative things frequently, negative from my perspective. But being designated as a city of gastronomy, the only one in the United States, I'm seeing ripple effects from that. And food is the reason, not because we, you know, people say, is that because we have a lot of nice restaurants? That is such a minuscule part of it. We have many exciting things going on here with food systems and food scarcity and, you know, the Gary Nabhan. I mean,
right. Everything's
native seed search.
Right.
So many of those things. So biosphere is really a part of that.
Right. You mentioned Gary. He's going to be one of the speakers at the One Young World.
He should be.
Yeah.
He's one of the top three guests I was afraid of that ever came to Mrs. Green's world. And he's the one who said, Mrs. Green, why don't we relax and laugh? And it was like fun from then on because we had so much fun. He's brilliant.
He is.
He's absolutely and positively brilliant. I said, Gary, what do you expect? He wrote 26 books, I think. It's like, yeah, that's rather intimidating, but he's a treasure. I mean, he's a treasure for the planet. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about, is there anything else you want to say about One Young World?
No, I hope you, we're going to send you an invitation so at least you can
meet some of the people. I am going to be on the phone with Kevin Bonine before you pull out of the driveway.
I love it.
And say, Kevin, what parts of this, it's really important because I'll tell the world.
Sure.
And that's what I love about our thousands of listeners from around the country. They'll hear this and they'll come to Biosphere 2 when they come to Tucson. There's no doubt in my mind. Okay, beyond B2 events, you're doing lots of fun things out there. So talk to us about the beyond B2 events.
This goes back to the idea that Southern Arizona can be something very special, even more special than it is now. So right now, we're known, as you mentioned, we just became the city of gastronomy.
That's a big deal.
It's a big deal. It absolutely is a big deal. And sort of connected to that, we have a university which is a powerhouse in environmental issues. There's no doubt about it. You know, we have the Institute of the Environment, and I can go on and on. So we have that, and we have, as all universities do, but not with the specific strengths that we have in the environment, we have all these millenniums, right? And many of them, are at One Young World, but many of them are at our university, are just dying to make a difference.
Yes, that's absolutely true.
So Beyond B2 is, I'm trying to create an ecosystem in which within the University of Arizona, we can educate our undergraduate students on issues that pertain the environment, high-tech issues that can fix them, all right? There's a little organization called Innovate UA, which is for our undergraduate students to get involved in this kind of stuff. So they're the ones that are actually running it. It's so really cool. We're just sort of trying to run as quickly as they can so that we can keep things.
Which is why we love those young people.
Yeah, from collapsing around us.
But don't hold us back.
That's right. So in partnership with the Vice President for Research and Student Affairs, and a bunch of other people, we are creating the ecosystem so that our students can get the opportunities that they need to be effective if they want to start something like that. And Beyond B2 then goes beyond that, just being at the university. How can we create then an ecosystem outside of the university where these students, which are already all fired up and have a lot of tools to get these things done, do it here instead of going elsewhere?
So exciting. Keep mm-hmm. them here. Keep those young minds here. Let's keep it going.
Right. And you know, if you want to think about in a classic way or in a very specific way, it's the model of what happened in Palo Alto, where it was the students actually that created the high-tech environment that they're in, right? Coming out of the university.
Right.
Google did not move from Boston to Palo Alto. It was invented in Palo Alto.
Right.
And Facebook, although it was thought about at Harvard, it was, you know, he was a student at Harvard, it was actually done in Palo Alto. So you create an ecosystem that then just explodes. And I want the ecosystem that we create here in Southern Arizona, it's not going to be about biotech, and it's going to be about these technologies. It's going to be, how do you make a difference in the world through imaginative new technologies that we can develop and that our students will be doing.
Excited.
So that's what we're trying to do.
But it's so exciting. And when you go downtown, I was downtown last week, and we have struggled so much as a community in our identity and growth and what's good growth and not letting things in that I, of course, thought would have been good things for the community. But if you go downtown, just as an observer, everywhere you look, there's building going on.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere you look, there's new restaurants being opened. Everywhere you look, there's new businesses moving down. I went downtown around the Cushing Street area.
Mm-hmm.
It's so, there's unbelievable, robust, exciting things happening.
Yep.
So this is just another component to that that's so important, because those of us that live here and work here want to see all these kind of things happen.
Right.
Tell us about the online chemistry course and the Google Award. What's that all about?
I don't know.
You don't? It's like, oh, Frankie.
I actually don't know about what the Google about is all about, but I can tell you that we are working really hard and diligently in creating online courses and majors within the College of Science. We've just...
That really matters. Like, let me press pause here. It really matters.
Does matter.
If you're working and you want to continue and your classes are from 8 to 5, you're cut out.
Right. But they have to be done right, right? I mean, there's already a lot of sad stories out there in the internet of companies that make a lot of money and actually don't educate the students. Because for people like you and for me, having something on the web that you can go and learn from is okay. But what we don't want to do is leave those that need more help than ever, that may be the ones that want to take these courses, just fail because they need more help.
Right.
So that's the challenge, right? And that's what we're working on now, and we're quite excited about it. Very excited. So the course in chemistry, which I knew about the course in chemistry, I just didn't know it got the award. I'm very proud of it.
But it just speaks volumes about the number of things that you have to keep watching and be aware of on a daily basis. I was cracking up when I was getting ready for this. I'm like, what do you decide every day what you're going to do?
And Frankie.
She's
the one that does it. Every morning she gives me a little card, says, this is what you have to do.
This is what time you have to show up.
Yeah.
Here's who's going to be there. Yeah. And this is what you need to go.
That's right.
Where would we be? You have a Frankie and I have a Kelly. And I'm like, I don't know. I mean,
is he trying to kill you? Frankie's trying to kill me. I'm sure.
Some days I call Kelly on the way to a meeting and I'll say, what am I meeting with this person about? And she cracks up. She said, you asked me to set that up like 6 weeks ago. And I said, yes. Yeah, so 6 weeks ago. We have to take another break. I still have lots of questions for Joaquin Riest, our in-studio guest. Stay here with me. We're going to talk a little bit about the lecture series that you started and the growth of that, and then a couple of Charlie Rose questions.
I love it.
Please stay here with me. Everybody, we'll be right back.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And it would be I would be hard-pressed to come up with a show topic that is more important to all of us. Our very lives depend on some of the topics we're covering and on some of the work that's being done at the University of Arizona. And those of you that have been with me for a long time know that I don't say those things lightly. I am thrilled to have joining me in studio for this hour the Dean of the College of Science at the University of Arizona, Dr. Joaquin Riest, one of his many hats, trust me. He's also the Vice President of Innovation and Strategy, Executive Dean, College of Letters, Arts, and Science, Professor of Geosciences. And Joaquin, I just have to ask you, do you have to go to all those graduations?
I do. Oh, I love them, actually.
That's good.
I just love
them. That's good.
Knowing you, you probably do.
That's
unbridled
great.
Unbridled energy.
And smiles and love and family and accomplishments. So good for you. That's a lot of graduations you have to go
to. It also keeps my fashion in line. I get to see all these shoes that I've
Exactly. And Joaquin is known in Tucson for his uniform. He doesn't worry about it. He shows up in his jeans and his white shirt, and I'm thinking, lucky you. You always look nice, and you always look fresh, and you don't have to decide what to wear every day.
That's true. You know, and last week I heard Obama is the same way. He only has gray and blue suits. He says you can only think of a few things a day, and he's not going to worry about to wear. I'm actually even one step ahead of him. I only have one outfit.
It's really smart. You know, the owner of the I have to think of it. The Fed by Threads, Alok Apadurai. I went to a lecture that TMC puts on at La Encantada, and he just said, because there's such the filthy fashion industry, talk about social justice and cancer and trade and, you know, slaves. He has an outfit now. He's got a pair of jeans and white shirts that are all made in America, 100% organic cotton, you know,
on.
He goes, here's my outfits. I got to find the Mrs. Green outfit. I don't know.
It has to be green.
You don't see many women doing that. Let's be honest here. Okay.
I hope you look good in green.
I do. Sometimes when I go to be a guest speaker, the people will say to me, well, how come you're not wearing green? Like, there are other colors. But anyway, I wear green a lot. I think it's really important to talk about the University of Arizona Science Lecture Series. Mm-hmm. I cannot believe that you started that in 2006.
Yep.
This is the 10-year anniversary.
No,
I remember.
It's the 11th.
And I was saying, oh, that was only yesterday, because I thought it was. And when I looked at it, it was like the very first one. It was your vision. And I believe part of your vision was to open the University of Arizona up to the community and have people come in and come on campus and be really good partners. What was your vision, and did it shock you how unbelievably successful it's been? And I say that absolutely sincerely. You've got to get there early.
Yeah. Well, part of it was that, but the fundamental reason that drove me to start it, 11 years ago, you may remember that there was a court case in Pennsylvania about teaching intelligent design as a science course.
Yes.
And it got to their courts, and in the end, a judge, and I cannot remember his name now, wrote against it. So it didn't go through. And his comments that he made are extraordinary, actually. I've read them, and I recommend anybody who wants to read about that to read it. But the point was that...
But what would they Google? And I'm not kidding. What would they? Because our listeners will listen it.
I think that you'd have to go to the Pennsylvania case,
okay,
dealing with intelligent design taught in classes as part of the science curriculum.
That'll be, if you put intelligent design,
yeah,
2006.
Something like that. It's six or... Anyway.
Okay.
So I was reading about this case, and I felt that a very important part of universities, in addition to creating knowledge, is to transmit knowledge. And we do that reasonably well with our own students, but we have to continue educating our communities if we really want to have a functioning democracy. I mean, you and I have to vote, right? And sometimes we have to vote more and more about technological issues, or even issues as to whether intelligent design should be a science course. So, this is not a matter of religion versus science.
Right.
It's a matter of what's what. That's it. I mean, that's what I'm going to say. And what I felt that we needed to do was educate the community about what we understood about evolution. That's it. So I got together with the head of the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, Rick Michaud, and said, we should just have a lecture series. And what would make it different than what universities typically do, in which you bring one person and in an hour that person talks about some topic, I said, if we do this right, and we make it more than 1 hour, and we have a series of lectures, let's say five, in which if you take every one of those lectures, they're organized well enough so that if somebody comes to all of them, they really understand the field as well as
yes.
we all do,
yes.
right? Without the math or whatever, but you understand the concepts and you understand what we know and what we don't know. So we got all excited about it, and we did the first lecture of that lecture series was in the Center of Creative Photography. I wanted to do it in a nice place that only holds 250 people. And I was quite worried that we'd have 50 or something, you know. But
surprise!
In the end, about 500 people showed up to that first one. We had to turn back 500 people. 250 people or something.
I remember
like that.
It made the front page of the newspaper.
I know.
It was a big deal.
And we started getting worried about this sort of towards the day was. So we put TV screens outside.
Yes.
So at least people could watch
it.
But so then the next lecture said, well, we can't stay here. I mean, we obviously have 500 people. So we went to another lecture hall that had 500 people, and more than 500 people showed up. So anyway, that first year, we ended up in Centennial Hall.
Right, right.
And then we all sat there sort of in complete disbelief, and we said, well, clearly the community is interested in this, and let's just create a lecture series every year with a different topic. And the next year was global climate change. It was global climate change, that's right. And the rest is history.
The rest really is history.
And,
people line up. They block it out.
Right.
They're there. It is standing room only. It's never faltered.
Right. And what's really nice now is that, of course, what you've mentioned about creating a community with our city, I think that has happened. But the thing that I never envisioned would happen is that we've also created communities within the University of Arizona, because these lecturers that sometimes hadn't met each other even though we're all part of the university.
Yes, it's a big
now we're writing
campus.
Proposals together and are doing things together. So it's created communities within the university thanks to this lecture series.
And I'll bet a lot of people don't know that. They're hearing it first on Mrs. Green's World. Yeah. I mean, it really does matter.
Yeah.
It's the ripple effect, and it's like the whole conference attending thing. What about, do you know what you're going to do for 2017?
I really don't.
You don't?
No.
Okay. And do you coach, this is just a Gina question, some of the biggest challenges with scientists from where I sit, which is the purpose of Mrs. Green's World, is to get scientists to speak English, not science. Do you work with them to make sure there's not a lot of acronyms and a lot of, you want it to be smart, highly intelligent delivery, but you have to have it be translated to the masses.
Yeah. You cannot believe the amount of work that goes on into this.
I can believe it because they're so successful.
So the first thing that happens is that when we come up with a theme, I have a little committee that thinks about these themes, then we come up with the lecturers, and typically only about half of the ones that we need. We invite them, and then we ask them if they want to be part of this, and if they say yes, who's missing? And then we bring in everybody. So, okay, we have now the six people in the room, and I just tell them, create the lecture series. Who's going to speak about what? What are all the themes that we need to?
Right.
So then there are a couple of really interesting meetings in which everybody decides what needs to be part of the lecture series and who's going to talk about them. Because not everybody is talking about their expertise, and generally they're not. All right, when that's done, then there's a dry run that each one of these folks has to do in front of the group. So there's like the word police, as you mentioned.
Yes, and critiquing.
Yeah. And then we have a team which is led by a gentleman in town, Ken Godat, who has a company on design, and he helps the lecturers with a PowerPoint presentation.
It really
so that's
matters.
Why it doesn't look very clunky. It looks like a holistic, polished thing.
Very polished.
So it's an army of people that are working on this, and you know, there are people, I know you know some of them, like Jonathan Overpeck, who's given a lecture, who says he's never worked so hard in a lecture in his life.
I believe that.
And these
I
are
really
people,
do
these
believe
are
that.
People that go around giving lectures everywhere, right? So the reason that it's so good is because people put an enormous amount of effort into it.
And, you know, to some extent, the imitation is the highest form of flattery. The downtown lecture series has also been wildly successful. I was really involved with the food one last year, and I was on the committee to watch the presenters rehearse. It was darn hard. I'm not kidding. And critiquing them, it has to be X amount of time, and the slides have to be not so science heavy. It's a lot of work and so important for this community. Another big plus about things that I love about Tucson. So this is the Charlie Rose questions before we run out of time, because I got to get them in. Keeping up with things in your domain, not just afloat, keeping them afloat, but flourishing and nourishing and making sure that the U of A continues to be at the forefront in so many areas that are under your leadership, and they are. I'm not just saying that. This is a really outstanding university when it comes to issues of the environment and all that that means. Where are the donors in terms of what they're wanting to fund, and the other agencies like the science, NSF, and all of those? What are they getting excited about?
There is no single theme that excites the donors. Remember that in the College of Science, which is what I deal with, we go from cognitive science to space sciences to physics to, you know,
the world covered.
Really?
Yes.
So
it's true.
We've had a donor that's given us $20 million to build mirrors for the next telescopes. That's what sparked his imagination.
So important.
Right. And I can go on and on about examples of what donors want, but I think the common denominator about what donors want is quality, and they want to make a difference, and the way that they will make a difference is if they see that we can actually offer something that will make a difference with their support. So it's not same old, same old. It's something that has to be novel. It has to be exciting. It has to be transformative. And that's what we're all about. We're sort of, in some ways, we're sort of a little scrappy university. I mean, because if you look at us and you compare it to our peers, which is Caltech and Harvard, and these folks are swimming in cash.
Yes, and look what we've done.
And we,
seriously,
we are sort of scrappy, and we can keep going just because we're really smart, and I think it shows. A negative and a positive, for example, is that the biggest donors in the College of Science are amazingly accomplished individuals that are not even alumni.
That really matters. That really matters.
So that tells you, I mean, these are people that have been on the board of the Smithsonian, and I can just go on with their credentials, but they can see what we're doing, and not just in a way that, oh, look how fun it is. They can compare us to what they understand that's out there, and they still think that what we're doing is extraordinary. So I'm really proud of that. I think we need to do better with our alumni, actually, because it's sort of an embarrassment to me in some ways that all of our biggest donors are not alumni. And I think our alumni should be as excited about what we're doing as
at the head of the pack. I totally agree.
So that's a different story anyway. But the bottom line and the important point is that it's excitement, it's transformative. And whether you do it in mindfulness or you do it in particle physics, that just happens to be what an individual thinks is very exciting.
Right. And it's all part of the big thing we call the planet.
That's right.
All of them matters. There isn't, to me, a prioritization when it comes to that.
No.
At all. And that's what makes me excited. I want to ask you a tough question, and I know you'll tell me the truth, because I get asked it a lot. People say to me, after this is 9 years of interviewing really smart, transformative thought leaders and on, and young kids that are 13 years old that are saving gorillas in, you know, Indonesia. If we get things right in a hurry, and I mean in terms of climate change, flat out question, if we slow down CO2 emissions, if we start becoming really conscious and innovative about water and how we use it and on, what is your hope for the future?
Oh, I'm incredibly hopeful.
Yes, good answer. Thank you. We have to have hope.
Oh, absolutely. No, but I think the challenge to me is going to be, I think we will create technology that's going to blow everybody's socks off. I mean, I don't really even know what's going to be out there. I'm sure that cancer is going to be a chronic disease, for example, in the future. I mean, this business of driverless cars is going to be transformative with respect to emissions.
Oh, my God, that like scares the heck out of me.
Well, it's so exciting. Yeah, and in Tucson,
it'll
be an improvement, actually, so yeah, to have driverless cars. I can guarantee
I think
you
so
that.
Too.
But the point is that the minute that batteries kick in, that's also going to be a big difference. The point is all these things are going to happen.
And
the
it's happening faster.
Yeah, the question is going to be 5 years or 10 years or even less. So all of this is going to happen. I think to me, the challenges of the future are all social. They're very complicated. And even how you go to a country and work with new technologies, all of that is cultural, it's social. And I think that we've been ignoring the social sciences too much. Maybe not ignoring, but our funding agencies have certainly been ignoring our social sciences. And I think they're critical.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great note on which to end. And I encourage everybody to go to the University of Arizona, go to the Facebook page, that's U of A Science Lecture Series, and follow it and join the group. Go to arizona.edu. There's a lot of things that are happening here. We asked for a call to action. Do you have a call to action? Get engaged, get involved. What's your deep thought for our, we have thousands of listeners from all over the country.
Well, I think the fact that they're listening to you, they're already engaged. So I don't think,
that makes
I think
me
we're
happy.
Talking to the choir here. I think the real question is how do we talk to not the choir? And that's what I would urge
how
everybody to think about.
Yes. Yes, I love it.
Right? So
I'll put that as a tweet.
Yeah, how do you actually expand your circle of influence, or I shouldn't even say it that way. How do you actually have civil discourse so that you can discuss these issues and not make them personal and really sort of have people really become thoughtful?
I love that, and bring about greater impact, yeah. Because to know better is to do better. That's certainly been my journey. This has been a delightful hour. I hope you have all enjoyed it as much as I have. Thank you, Joaquin, with your busy schedule to come out here and do this. Marty Enriquez and Michael Duran next week, talking about hospitals and the healing environment with TMC, and on our Mrs. Green's World show, Leslie Meehan, co-founder of the Gaia Field Project. Can't wait to find out what that's all about. Make it a great green week, everybody. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.